Yeah, I think it's now recording.
Yeah, we're good to go.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for coming to my talk today. I'm going to present my lab's work, our achievements in the five past years since I came to Florida State University in 2016. So the topic today is for structural basis of interferon-induced host defense and viral counteracts. So first, I'm going to talk about how the host cell defending all the invading pathogens. And then I'm going to move on to how the pathogens, and in particular some viruses, using their own way to suppress a host defense mechanism. And if there's time, I would like to talk briefly about a new research interest in my lab that's actually also derived from my studies on the membrane enclosed pathogen niche. Let me see. All right, okay. So first, I will first want to talking about the pathogens. So most of the pathogens, be it bacteria or viruses, need to get into the cell, get inside of the cell and start to replicate using all the nutrients the cells can provide. Well, there are many ways for the pathogens to get into the cell. Usually, sometimes there is direct membrane fusion like enveloped viruses, but in many other cases, the viruses or bacteria get into the cell via process called endocytosis, or in the case for bacteria, it's also called phagocytosis. So the process is the pathogen will be enclosed in an invaginated cell membrane, and eventually the invagination increase and pinch off from the plasma membrane. And inside, this is a form more like endosome-like structure enclosed by membrane. The viruses and bacteria can actually replicate inside of the membrane structure, but at some time points, they will need to get out of the membrane structure, get into the cytosome, and start to be released from the cell to infect more healthy cells. While this actual replication inside of the cytoplasm is very dangerous to the pathogens. That's because there is multiple cytosolic immune sensors in the cell, and all of them will recognize one or another type of pathogenic molecules and initiate the whole innate immune defense mechanism. So of course, some of the pathogens will develop their own way to prolong this protection in the phagosome or endosome for as long as possible. And that is to increase their viability, to increase their viability and also to promote their proliferation, right? Especially bacteria, but also some other eukaryotic parasites can really create this niche for themselves. And this is a membranous structure and usually derived from the initial phagosome, from the initial phagocytosis. However, those bacteria or eukaryotic parasites can really remodel the phagosome and to usually, for example, to be more resistant to fusion with lysosomes, and they will remodel this into a pathogen-containing vacuoles or PCV. So now the bacteria will start to replicate inside the PCV. And staying inside of this PCV offers twofold of benefits. So first, this membrane really separated all the cytosolic immune sensors from the bacteria. So they will have a quite safe place to proliferate. Meanwhile, they can also get all the nutrients from the cell using some of the channels or transporters on the membranes. So they can still get nutrients to proliferate. And eventually when this number is getting too high for the cells to accommodate, they'll actually get into the cytosol or burst out of the cell to infect infect other healthy cells. All right, so this certainly leads to a benefit for the bacteria or eukaryotic parasites, but cells, the host cells, are not passive. They will not stand by either. And although we do not know how, we do know that many of those PCV enclosed bacteria can still be detected by the cytosolic immune sensors. So here is one. Do you see the next slice? Oh, now here it is. All right. So Francisella is an example of such detection. So Francisella is a vacuolar bacterium. They can remodel the phagosome and get into the sheltered life for a very long time. But still, we know that infection of the cell with Francisella can activate a very potent M2 inflammasome response. And this activation actually, it depends on the genomic DNA of the bacterium. And also M2 is a very strictly cytosolic protein. It will not get into the vacuole. So this poses some unanswered questions. The first is, how do those bacterium leave the vacuole and get into the cytoplasm? And of course, the second question, once the bacterium get into the cytoplasm, is how is the genomic DNA be exposed to the cytosol? This will certainly require certain leakage or disruption of the bacterium themselves. And if we see in a wider scenario for many other bacterium, the question becomes, how do bacteria or bacterial molecules, especially if those are vacuolar bacterium, their molecules gain access to the cytosol? There is always a passive way. That is, for some reason, the vacuole is not stable enough and the bacterium get leaked into the cytosol. And one or two of the bacterium, again, is not highly healthy. So their DNA getting accidentally leaked into the cytosol and the host cell pick it up. But you can imagine that those passive way is really not efficient for the cells. They may lead a benefit for the pathogen, but the cells certainly are in a very disadvantaged position. But actually, we believe the cells are not so passive, and there is an active way to disrupt those membrane barriers and even the membrane barriers of the bacterium themselves, and actively expose all the external molecules or organisms to the cytoplasmic immune sensors. And the proteins that can fill in the missing link seems to be this family of proteins, the interferon-inducible GTPases. Right, so interferon-inducible GTPases are not really new proteins. They were first discovered in the 1990s. And that's because they are potently induced by interferons, especially by interferon gamma, after virus or bacteria infection. Sometimes interferon usually can induce thousands of genes, but the GTPs is expressed at such a high level that sometimes more than 20% of all the protein mass after interferon treatment actually are the GTPases. And this certainly speaks of their importance in the antimicrobial defense. So the proteins my lab has been focusing on in the past years are this subfamily, the guanylate binding proteins, and also called GBPs. So GBPs, I'm a structure biologist, so I'll be talking about more from the protein side of the genes. Can you see the movement of the mouse?
Yes.
Okay. It's frozen at my side. All right. Anyway, those TPP proteins, they have this G domain at the N-terminus, and this bear resemblance to small GTPs is with all the green vertical bars actually really means all the G motifs that are common in small GTPs. But it does have a C-terminal extension. It's like about 300 amino acids that are mostly helical. And those GBP proteins, although they bear resemblance to small GTPs, they also are different. They do not need all the accessory proteins like DAP or GAF proteins to complete a GTP hydrolysis cycle. And sometimes they also have a very peculiar way that can hydrolyze GTP all the way to GMP. Another feature of those family of proteins is they can associate with membranes, especially GBP1, 2, and 5. So at the very C-terminus of the proteins, there's a cysteine that can be modified by lipid. And after modification, and this is called isoprenylation, right? So after this isoprenylation, 1, 2, and 5 can be inserted into membranes via this isoprenyl chain. Other GBPs lack this modification site, so they will mostly be in the cytosome. So when only 1, 2, and 5 can be recruited to the membranes. So my lab started to study GBP2 property, and we start from the solution first. So we started with GBP2 because it's certainly the top induced GBP proteins. And also there is a lack of structure knowledge of GBP2. There's a freeze. Okay. I'm sorry, there seems to be a freeze. Oh, now it comes out. Okay. All right. So we can purify the GBP2 protein from E. coli. And as we know that it hydrolyzes GTP, we naturally want to study its behavior in different guanine nucleotide binding status. So actually this is very surprising as the protein GBP2, usually we use size exclusion chromatography to study the oligomeric states of the protein. Okay, so the markers on top of this chromatography are the standard proteins marking the size of the proteins. At my side, the mouse is really crazy. See. All right. So if you can see the blue line and the green line. So GBP2, when it's bound to GDP or GMP-PMP, GMP-PMP is a non-hydrolyzable GTP mimic. So this is both before GTP hydrolysis and after GTP hydrolysis. So GBP2 is a monomer. But if we incubate GBP2 with GDP plus aluminum fluoride, so this is a very well established mimic for GTP hydrolysis transition state. So if you can look at the red line, so when GBP2 is incubated with this transition state mimic, it forms a dimer. And only at this stage, it will form a dimer. And we know this dimerization is coupled to GTP hydrolysis is if we mutate the active site lysine. If you look at the pink one, if we mutate this lysine to alanine and essentially kill the enzymatic activity, GBP2 is no longer a dimer, even in the presence of the transition state mimic. So it seems that the GBP2 before and after hydrolysis will both be a monomer, but at the moment of this transition state or in the middle of hydrolysis, GBP2 can dimerize. So the next step is we investigate whether we can use a G-domain to recapitulate the behavior of Fulin's GBP2. Since for practical reasons, GBP2 is difficult to express, and we can get a large amount of GBP2 G-domain without an issue. But what caught us in surprise is the G-domain. Although this is where the enzymatic activity lies, does not behave exactly like the Fulin's protein. Right? Of course, post-hydrolysis in GDP bond form, both Fulin's and G-domain are monomer. But before hydrolysis, when bind to GMP-PMP, the Fulin's is a monomer, but the G-domain is already a dimer. Again, during the transition state, they behave reversed. GBP2 Fulin's will be predominantly dimer when bound to GDP plus aluminum fluoride, but the G-domain is really a mixture of a dimer and a monomer, and even the dimer actually is a minor species. Well, this prompts us to ask whether those extra C-terminal region will somehow promote the GTP's activity allosterically. So we use a colorimeric way to measure the GTP's activity. This actually is getting more surprised is, well, we'll see there is no apparent difference between the Fulin's and the G-domain protein. And if you really want to see if there is difference, the G-domain seems to be more active, slightly more active than Fulin's protein at the same concentration. Right. So we wanted to know whether the structure basis of such differences. So we tried to crystallize GBP2, either Fulin's or G-domain, and in different guanine nucleotide binding states. So we got the first structure is the G-domain structure and in the presence of GDP. So here is a GDP bounded to the G-domain of GBP2. This is a post-hydrolysis product bound state. And if we zoom in to the active site, we can see all the G motifs and as where they're expected to be. So G1, G2, and G3, these three highly conserved motifs really wraps around the diphosphate moiety. And at the other end of the protein, at the other end of the binding pocket, the G4 motif block the end of the guanine base, and the guanine cap here actually lay on top of the guanine base, but also make contact with the ribose. And we can identify all the crucial residues, especially on the diphosphate binding side. The lysine directly coordinate with the beta phosphate of GDP. And the arginine 48 slightly swings outward and no longer make contact with this part. This is also consistent with this is the product bound form and GDP is supposed to be quickly released. Okay, also what's surprised us actually is this E99 residue. It points also into the phosphate binding site. Remember, phosphate is negatively charged, and this glutamic acid residue is also negatively charged. And this, we think, create a repulsion between the protein and the GDP. So another residue that's in the G2 motif mentioned previously is S33, but in the structure, we observed it's far away, very far away from the binding site and makes no contact with the GDP. Right, so to validate our observation in the crystal structure, we mutated all the crucial residues, including 48, K51, and this very interesting E99. So aside from S33, the yellow line here, all the other mutation either completely abrogated the enzymatic activity, or reduced activity by, let's see, 70, 60, 70%. And this actually is consistent with our observation of the crystal structure, that is, all of our 48, K51, and E99 are very close to the phosphate. And S33 is far away, does not make any contact. So mutating it does not affect the enzymatic activity. And again, we're now, we can be sure that the E99 orientation we observed in the crystal structure is not a real artifact, as mutating of this residue into other amino acids either completely or partially reduced the enzymatic activity. Well, we got the product bound form of GBP2, and there is already a published structure of GBP1 bound to GMP-PMP, so that is the substrate binding form. When we superpose those two structures, there's immediate difference. That's very drastic movement of the G2 motif. Actually, one is here and part of the other region that in the widely switched to region. But I also want to point out here, this region, the last alpha helix of the G domain. And this is actually on the opposite side of the active site. And the movement may seem not to be much here, but as we will see, actually it will couple the movement to the C-terminal region and leads to very drastic conformational change. Right. And if we look at the active site in atomic details, it's getting even more clear why this is a GDP bound form and why it will be quickly, why the GDP will be quickly expelled. Right. So the gray one, the gray structure is a GMP-PMP bound form. So one of the threonine here actually is very close to the phosphate and is coordinating with magnesium ion. And magnesium ion is absolutely necessary for the GTP's activity. So after hydrolysis with the large conformational change of the G2 motif, this T75 residue moves so far away from the active site that the magnesium will lose coordination and actually will be quickly released from the protein. And there's also the E99 before hydrolysis is pointing away and creating a space for the phosphate to occupy here. After hydrolysis, it swings 120 degrees. And now this actually occupies a previously gamma phosphate position, also very close to the beta phosphate. And this same charge will create a very strong repulsion now to push out the GDP, right? So with the structure, it's very clear that after GTP hydrolysis to GDP, the active site is rearranged to first exclude magnesium ion and then to expel GDP. And now reaction is terminated and the protein is ready for the next cycle of hydrolysis. We can also see from the structure that the GDP bound form, we already know that the GDP bound form is monomeric. And from the structure, we can see why it's monomeric, because the conformation is not compatible with the dimer formation. There will be huge structure clashes here. The blue one is a GDP bound form, and the gray one here is a dimer form. There's a direct clash of the switch two region into the other protomer of the dimer. And that's why after hydrolysis, the GBP protein will quickly fall apart into the monomeric form. So later we were able to get the fullens GBP2 structure. Although we only got it in the nucleotide free form. So here the blue part again is a G domain, and we can see the C-terminal helical region extending out more about 19 angstroms from the G domain, right? And if we rotate the structure, and we can see the very long alpha 12 moving outwards and folding back into the last alpha helix, alpha 13. And this is how the alpha 12, alpha 13 docks onto the G domain. It's mostly electrostatic interaction, which actually will be weakened, will be easier to break. Well, again, we want to compare our structure with other structures, with other known structures. And this is a nucleotide-free form of GBP2. If we superpose this structure with nucleotide-free GBP1 structure, the G-domain part superposes very well, but we observe a very large movement at the other end of the C-terminal helical region. So the tip moves almost about 18 angstroms, and we can clearly identify the hinges at this link, but also starting shifting, swinging using this first alpha helix in C-terminal helical region. So this superposition seems to suggest GBP1 or GBP2 have a very flexible nature, and their C-terminal helical region can really move about, but we want to know whether the movement of the C-terminal helical region has anything to do with the G domain, especially if there has anything to do with GTP binding and hydrolysis. Well, while we're working with more structures, we collaborated with Wei Yang in Department of Chemistry to carry out molecular dynamics simulation. So here is our crystal structure, and the red star here is active site. And this is a very long running site and is still ongoing. But if we take some snapshots, we can already observe the flexibility of the molecule, right? So here is one snapshot during the long simulation process. And if we move back and forth, you can see the active site movement is coupled with the C-terminal region, and especially the last alpha helix of the G-domain here almost work as a lever. And during the GTP binding and hydrolysis process, actually it is pushing down on the C-terminal helical region and leads to the movement of the whole C-terminal helical region. Right. So throughout the simulation, we can observe that the C-terminal helical region movement is completely coupled with the G-domain active site rearrangement. That is, the movement of the active site is transduced to the other side of the molecule. And this is also the case if we comb through literature and using all the other GBP1 structures. So this is the end of simulation and other published structures. Even when the G domains are aligned very well, the C-terminal helical region display a very large range of movement, and especially the last one. So this structure lacks the last two alpha helices that can really anchor the C-terminal region to the G domain. And also, the only connection is here, the peptide bond between G-domain and the C-terminal helical region. And again, this shows the largest movement so far. We also tested this deletion mutant on GBP2, and actually it so far is the most stable dimer we've seen. That is, it is dimer in both GMP, PMP, and GDP plus aluminum fluoride form. So we do have a hypothesis that those two alpha helix can really stabilize the C-terminal helical movement, and they can removing of those alpha helix promote dimerization, and adding those two alpha helix, that is, so which means in the fullness GBP2, it elevates the GBP2 activation threshold. And this may be important in the cells, so the GBP proteins will not be accidentally activated without the infection of pathogens. So all the GBP1, 2, and 5, when infection takes place, they will move from cytosol to the PCVs, the pathogen-containing vacuoles. But this depends on the C-terminal isoprenylation of the proteins. Well, we are working to get isoprenylated GBP2, but the yield is very low. So right now we're using the isoprenylated. This farnesylation is a one form of isoprenylation, GBP1, to first characterize its association with GBP with the membrane structures. We expect GBP1 and 2 will behave very similarly in terms of lipid or membrane association. So actually it is true that the farnesylation is necessary for GBP to be associated with lipids or membranes, but this is not sufficient. So when we see that incubated with different guanine nucleotides, only in the presence of GDP plus aluminum fluoride, that means only in the dimeric active form, will this GBP1 associate with liposomes. So now we know that both modification and GTP hydrolysis are necessary for the GBP protein to be associated with membranes. And we want to investigate what GBP look like on the membrane in the dimer form. So right now we only have some preliminary pieces of information, and we're trying to get you more data to support our hypothesis. So far there's only the G domain dimer structure, but we combined with our full-length GBP2 structure, we can build a dimer, full-length GBP2 dimer model. And this is with this C-terminal modification, we can also kind of position the dimer onto the membrane. So in this model, GBP2 has a very opened form. So the two C-terminal helical regions point away from each other. And this spans a very long distance, more than 200 angstroms. And then we're calling this form the open form. We're using the schematic way to show it. If we're using this model and doing some projection, the molecules should look like this, like thin thread under electron microscopy, this open form of GBP dimer. But instead, when we really look at those dimers under an EM, those long thin form is not what we see. We can get mostly the structure we saw actually are very compact, circular, sometimes even donut-like shapes with a hole in the middle. And we think this represent a closed form that depends on the large scale conformational change of GBP2. And we think this open form and the closed form induced by GTP hydrolysis, when both molecules are anchored to the membrane, will also cause large curvature change in the membrane. And when multiple molecules are associated with the same membrane structure, this large scale movement will collectively deform or maybe even rupture the membrane. And this could be the structure basis of GBP dependent lysis of both the pathogen containing vacuoles or even the lysis of the bacteria outer membrane. Right. So to summarize this GBP project, so far we have established that GBP2 can form dimer upon GTP hydrolysis. And this hydrolysis will induce large scale conformational change at the G domain active site. The G domain active site conformation change actually is transduced across long distance to the C-terminal helical domain, and that will lead it to assume a closed conformation upon dimerization GTP hydrolysis. And we cannot rule out another possibility that this dimerization can lead to a secondary interface that will stabilize a dimer. And lipid modified GBP1 and likely GBP2 can only associate with liposomes in the dimer form. And this creates a very quick on and off mechanism for the GBP proteins to get on and off the passagen containing vacuoles. All right, so next I'm going to switch gear and move to the viral counteracts. All right, so GBP proteins can be induced by interferons, and interferons can be activated by both virus and bacteria infection. But viruses are particularly strong interferon inducers, and especially for some DNA viruses. Right. So now we know that the DNA derived from viruses activate a protein called cGAS in the cytoplasm. It can bind to cGAS, causes conformational change, and now the active cGAS will synthesize a cyclic dinucleotide, usually called a cGAMP. Right, and this cyclic dinucleotide binded to another protein called STING, and after a series of signaling events, the cell is now producing a large amount of interferons. Right, so interferons, of course, leads to the activation of about 2,000 genes, and many of them can work to suppress viral infection and eventually clear the cell of viruses. But along the long years of co-evolution of viruses with host cells, viruses also develop their own strategies to suppress interferon production. And probably the most direct way is to inhibit the cGAS activation, as cGAS is really the initiator of the whole signaling cascade. So today I'm going to talk about two different strategies using either by KSHV or dengue virus to inhibit interferon production by targeting the cGAS activation. Right. So actually, it's really our colleague, Fan Xiu, is among the first labs to identify a viral inhibitor of cGAS. And this is from the virus his lab has been working on, the KSHV Kaposi sarcoma herpes virus. So it is a DNA virus, and it's very clear that one of the protein ORF52 or KSHV inhibitor of cGAS, kick gas, it can really inhibit the interferon production in a cGAS dependent way. So when ORF52 is expressed, the cGAS dependent interferon production is greatly suppressed. And we can see this both using just transfection or using infection. So it is very clear that ORF52 or kick gas can inhibit cGAS signaling. And after I came here, Fan Xiu and I worked together to get to the molecular mechanism of this inhibition. So we know that kick gas actually bound to double-stranded DNA with very high affinity. And this ISD25 means a 25 base pair DNA, and ISD45, this is a 45 base pair. And you can see this is the longer the DNA, the higher the binding affinity. And this actually, we find out the basis for this higher affinity later in a couple of slides. All right, so kick gas can bind to DNA, and it also inhibits cGAS activity. So here, without any additional kick gas, cGAS is very active in synthesizing cGAMP. But if we increase the ORF52 amount, the cGAS activity gradually diminished, and eventually cake gas can completely inhibit C-gamp synthesis by C-gas, right? Well, we using some very, using the established way to figure out the highly conserved residues in cake gas. So cake gas is, KSH3 is a herpes virus, and these residues are absolutely very strictly conserved in all herpes viruses. So we mutated these residues, and you can see especially mutation of this four residues, I21, L24, N28, L31, actually reduces the cake gas binding to DNA. And this reduction in affinity correlates very well with its inhibition of C-gas activity. So Y-type cake gas can reduce C-gas activity by to 10%, but if mutation of those residues essentially removed all the inhibition, especially L24 and L31. So the binding of the binding D to DNA, binding affinity to DNA and inhibition of C-gas is very well correlated. Well, this actually raises some question. As we know, cake gas binds to DNA and likely using a charge-charge interaction. But none of these residues is charged or even polar. So this certainly raises a question of how do those mutations affect the DNA binding affinity as well as C-gas inhibition. One thing we observed is cake gas is usually an oligomeric protein. It's difficult to get its absolute number of oligomer as there seems to be a distribution. But all the mutants here actually shifted the oligomer to dimers, and all of them will assume the dimer form. Well, eventually, after about 3 years' work, we solved the structure of the cake gas ORF52 core. And as we see in the crystal structure, the minimum unit of cake gas or ORF52 actually is a dimer. And the first alpha helix swings out from the central core part and getting out. But this is only the minimum unit. If we look into the crystal lattice, actually, it can really form an infinite chain. So each alpha 1 helix will dimerize with another alpha 1 helix from the neighboring molecule. And this dimer-dimer interface eventually will link all the molecules to a very long linear chain. And looking at the dimer interface, all those residues 21, L24, and 28, and L31 are strictly conserved, and they all point towards each other, forming the dimer very tight leucine zipper. Mutation of any of those residues actually will abrogate this dimerization, and as we see in the previous slides, greatly diminished DNA binding and C-gas inhibition. And now with the ORF52 forming the infinite long chain, we also know the high affinity of the ORF52 with DNA, especially with longer DNA. So if we turn the molecule by 90 degree, we can see all the positively charged residues on one side of the molecule. So the R97, another strictly conserved residue, and also our four arginine cluster, which is not included in the crystal structure, are all on the same side of the molecule. And if you model all those DNA binding residues in the long chain, we can see alternating DNA binding site on top of the, on both sides of the long chain of cake gas. And now, of course, with multiple DNA binding sites, the longer DNA will have an even higher binding affinity with the oligomeric kick gas. All right, so now I'm going to switch gear again and talking about another mechanism of viral disarming of the C-gas steam pathway. And this actually is from dengue virus. So dengue virus has a protease called NS2B3-pro. It actually can cut the steam, the protein that is downstream of C-gas. And there's also a report that NS2B3 can, part of the protein, the protease, the NS2B part, can really work as adapter protein and shuttle C-gas to the lysosome. And this, of course, will lead to its eventual degradation as well. So dengue virus protein can certainly target both C-gas and steam to reduce interferon production. What we are interested to see is whether dengue virus protease can directly cut and inactivate C-gas, like what it does to steam. Well, the answer is yes. So we can purify both proteins in the pure form, C-gas and NS2B3-pro, and after incubating together, we see a very clear cleavage of C-gas. There are four potential cleavage sites, and by mutating them one by one, we identify this third position as the major cleavage site of C-gas, on C-gas, and site two is a minor cleavage site here. So C-gas is a two-part protein. It has an N-terminal disordered region shown here in light blue, and the active, the C-terminal part that has a C-gamp enzymatic activity shown here in green. So cutting here actually creates two fragments or two cleavage products. We call them CPN and CPC. All right, so notice here the CPC actually retains all the enzymatic activity of full-length C-gas. And yet we know that from infection studies that cleavage is probably still diminished the antiviral potency of C-gas. So we want to see whether there is a molecular basis to that. And indeed, even when the CPC contains all the enzymatic domain, still it is less active than full-length C-gas. And now we know that this lower activity is likely due to the lower affinity to DNA. So C-gas activation absolutely requires DNA binding. And full-length C-gas binds to DNA with 40 nanomolar affinity, but the two fragments actually binds to DNA with like more than 100, or in this case it's even 200 nanomole affinity. That's like a threefold and almost sixfold reduction in terms of affinity. So cleavage of C-gas by the dengue protease created two fragments, and the C-gamp synthesizing part have lowered binding affinity, so also lowered activity. And what's more is an N-terminal fragment. Although it does not have any enzymatic activity, it can bind to DNA, shield those DNA from the active cleavage products or even full-length C-gas. So now this further reduced C-gas activity and C-gamp production. Right, so here we propose this dual inhibition of C-gas by dengue virus cleavage. So intact C-gas will have very high affinity towards double-strand DNA, and it can synthesize C-gamp with very little viral DNA present. But after cleavage, the part that can still synthesize C-gamp has much lower affinity towards DNA and is less efficient in synthesizing C-gamp. And the free N-terminal part, now by binding to DNA with medium or relatively high affinity, can inhibit both the C-terminal fragment or compete with the intact C-gas. And in both cases, this competition will reduce C-gamp synthesis, and reduce all the downstream immune signaling. All right, to summarize those two parts is, we think KSHV kick gas protein inhibits C-gas activity by binding to DNA. And this binding high affinity to DNA is really through the oligomeric nature of the K-gas protein. And disruption of the oligomer will greatly reduce DNA binding and C-gas inhibition of K-gas. In the case for dengue virus, this protease NS2B3 can cut C-gas in the N-terminal region, and that reduces the activity of the C-terminal fragments, while the N-terminal part will also compete for DNA and further reduces activation of C-gas and the production of C-gamp. All right, I'll quickly go through the last part of today's presentation, is if we'll go back to the initial phagocytosis of bacteria or viruses. And in many cases, the viruses can get into the cell via the clathrin-mediated endocytosis, or CME. So viruses will engage some receptor on the cell surface, and that will lead to recruitment of endocytic proteins, forming a pit, wrap it around with clathrin, eventually invaginate to the point that the neck will be cut by dynamine and forming a free vesicle, standalone vesicle. The vesicle will get into the cytosol, and later it will uncoat, recycle all the endocytic proteins, and release and get to the free endocytic vesicles. And those endocytic vesicles and the cargo inside of the vesicle can be either recycled or degraded, depending on the cargo nature. And the viruses often exploit this pathway to gain entry into the cell. Some of the coronaviruses can really engage cell surface receptor and get into and start to infect the cells in this way. All right, so, but the clathrin, those green bar here, do not directly interact with the cargo protein. So there has to be a link between cargos and the clathrin. And adapter protein, adapter complex two, shown here, a tetrameric complex, is a link between the cargo, usually transmembrane proteins, and the clathrin cage, right? So adapter proteins binds to the cargo proteins at using one end and engage the clathrins using the other end, the ear part, and they can go through the whole cycle to form clathrin-coated vesicles that also be recycled and get back to the cell plasma membrane again. All right, so it's been long established that AP2 complex is a tetrameric complex containing four subunits, alpha, beta, mu, and sigma. So all the proteins are also called adaptins. So in 2019, a Shen lab in University of Colorado actually identified a protein alpha and gamma adaptin binding protein AGAP as essential regulator of AP2 complex assembly. So without AGAB, there is no endocytosis, and the marker proteins will stay on the cell membrane all the time instead of being constantly recycled into the cell, the inside of the cell. And further, they identify the way for AGAB to govern the assembly is AGAB can bind to both the alpha subunit and the sigma subunit, and essentially promoting the AP2 assembly. Of course, this is a very new discovery, and my lab's work is to figure out the molecular and structural mechanisms of this interaction. We found out that AGAB actually is a tetrameric protein. It is about 35 kD, but in solution, take a form about 158 kilodalton. And further, we identify these very small pieces in the C-terminals of A-gap. Actually, is sufficient, is essential and sufficient for tetramerization. And we call this tetramerization domain. We were able to crystallize a tetramerization domain and get this determine its structure. So each TD, can see using here, each TD actually is an arc-like alpha helix bend in the middle. And two of these alpha helices intertwine together. And again, those dimer will dimerize with the other dimer using this anti-parallel interface. So we'll be able to identify three of those crucial residues on the interface. And mutating those residues to arginine actually, as we expected, disrupted A-gap tetramerization. And those triple mutant actually also disrupt interactions with the alpha subunit interaction. So Y-type AP2-alpha can pull down, this is AP2-alpha, it can pull down Y-type A-gap, but it cannot efficiently pull down the 3R mutant here. And also this 3R mutant is defective in the cells in terms of endocytosis. Certainly those results will speak of the importance of that interfacial residues. More recently, we were able to get to figure out another interaction. Is the G domain of A-gap actually interact with the sigma subunit of the AP2 complex? And we identify this as a novel interface, as usually G protein will use in this side to interact with other proteins, but what we observe is completely different surface for interaction. And we can validate this interaction by mutagenesis. Those residues will completely abrogate interaction with a sigma subunit, right? So GBP, GST tag, AP2 sigma 1 can pull down A-gap GD, but not those mutant. So here, because these two proteins are all very similar molecular weight, we cut off the tab to make sure that actually in this band, there are two proteins, both GST AP2 sigma 1 and his sumo GD. Right. So these are the ongoing studies in my lab, and I'll wrap it up quickly. So we found out the C-terminals of A-gap mediates both its own tetramerization and also interaction with alpha-2 subunit. And we now can visualize the tetrameric interface by crystal structure. And those interface residues also mediate interaction with AP2 alpha subunit. And we can also identify the G-domain residues that are crucial for sigma subunit interaction. And we can validate both interactions using in vitro recombinant protein, but also with their effect in the cells in terms of class-mediated endocytosis. All right, so now I really have a long list of thank yous. Of course, everybody in my lab actually worked very hard to get these results, especially being a senior postdoc in the lab, actually worked on both GBP and A-gap structure, especially on the very difficult crystallography and EM studies. Yuan initiated many of the purification of the proteins. Shenyan Tan and Maddy actually worked on the GBP projects, and Maddy also worked on the dengue virus project. Rui is another graduate student recently joined my lab, and he actually has already generated a large amount of data on the A-gap project. My lab collaborated with Wei Yang on the molecular dynamic simulation, and also Stott gave us many advices on the lipid biochemistry. The KSHV project is in collaboration with Fan Xiu, and I'm very grateful to have many close, very insightful discussion with him, and also Debbie, the postdoc in Fan Xiu's lab. The A-gap project cellular work is in collaboration with Shen Lab in University of Colorado in Boulder. And I would really like to thank my ad hoc committee. They are very gentle, but also very firm in guiding me back to the right track, especially when I am distracted or sometimes confused. And I would like to thank all the facility staffs in FSU, both in biology and IMB. And lastly, the funding agencies, both the startup from FSU and the NIH for funding the studies. Lastly, just this is a snapshot of my lab in the post-pandemic era. Shantan, Bing, Debbie, Ray, and Maddie. With this picture, I will conclude my talk, and I will be happy for any suggestions and comments.
Great. I think people can just unmute themselves to ask questions. Wow, we do a virtual applause.
Thank you.
Or people can type in the chat box if they want to do that for question.
Or maybe I ask one. Okay,
sure.
So I would like, it's a very nice talk. So anyway, so I would like to ask a question about the GPP. So I don't know, I mean, the mechanism of, I mean, the antiviral, it's not very well understood, right? So, I mean, how exactly this familial protein actually to execute their antiviral activity. Looks like they have to bind to, I mean, GDP, then have some impact on the membrane, right? So
right.
Now with the structure insights, so I mean, how you can speculate, I mean, what exactly those type of protein do to restrict the viral infection.
Right, so actually, you're right. There's the evidence of its antiviral effect is really just start to show up, right? We have very little, we know it from infection at, experiments, but actually no biochemistry or structure is available. So if I am to do an educated guess, one possibility is actually the GPP proteins may interact with the capsid of the virus. This is actually because are closely of another family of the interferon inducible GDPs is called MX protein.
Yeah, that is very well known, right? I mean, that
yes.
MX2, I mean, it's a...
Yeah, and it's been clearly shown those MX proteins can actually forming a very large, almost a cage-like structure outside of the HIV capsid. And in somehow that will lead to the premature uncoating of those virus. So it could be similarly that the GBP proteins will also form in a similar structure that can interfere with a capsid of other viruses and leads to its restriction. But yeah, very few studies on that, in that area.
But you mentioned that 20% of proteins, right? Induced proteins are GBP. So whether those just the GPP 1 to 7 or also include the MX protein?
Okay. So GPP proteins, this is actually, it's more like a genetic studies.
Oh. So
people remove the large chunk of those GPP cluster on chromosomes. So it's really a mixture of GBP proteins that contains actually multiple, probably 1, 2, 5, and 3, I think, in one of the cluster. So it again, also GBP protein can heterodimerize. So maybe they will also compensate for each other. They have share some redundancies.
So Chin, there's a question in the chat box from Kay. Can you see it? I can read it to you.
I think I can see it. Okay. Are proteins that cleave cGAS found outside the flavivirus? Right now, it is unclear, as I think there may be, but simply there's no data suggesting that. One thing that is actually it's not really from viruses, but human proteins, a caspase can also cut cGAS in almost exactly the same position. And that caspase cleavage of cGAS actually is a one way to reduce the chance of autoimmunity. That is, the cell will not be overstimulated. So I do think this cleavage mechanism is conserved.
Okay, that's really interesting. Thanks.
Other questions?
Oh, hi, this is Steve. I have a question.
Sure.
So I have this sort of weird hypothesis that lipid composition is maybe a mechanism of regulation of certain processes in vivo. And, I was wondering if the composition is known of the pathogen containing vacuoles and how that might compare to the vesicles that you were using.
Yeah, well, actually that's a very interesting question. And this is my lab's next 2 years work. And we're trying to figure out the composition. So in theory, all those vacuoles are derived from the plasma membrane. So they should have, or at least at the early stage, they should have very similar composition as a plasma membrane, right? So right now we're using the natural membrane, and that's the liposome assay you saw. And we do, Roy's next step is to test individual or combination of those lipids to see which actually confers the binding. Yeah. Right now, we're really hindered by everything's backordered.
Oh, that's great. We'll have to talk more about that.
I know. We should talk more.
Thanks.
Sure. Always a good outcome of a seminar that people want to talk more. I know there's sometimes a delay, so we're waiting for there will be more questions.
If you're interested in looking at bacterial lysis, I don't know. If you're just interested in looking at enterics or another sorts of bacteria.
Sorry, Kate, can you see that again? I didn't catch.
I was just saying, if you're interested in looking at bacterial lysis, if you're interested in looking at anything besides enterics or things like that.
Right now we're trying, right now everything in my lab are so far are just still biochemistry. So we do want to move into the more physiological or pathogenic scenarios.
Cool, thanks.
All right, I'm going auctioneer, going once, going twice. Sold. Thank you very much, Chin, for a very fascinating talk. Like I said, last colloquium. So you got field work for summer, a great summer. Thank you, everyone, for joining this talk. And we'll see each other around, hopefully very soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Chen.
Thank you.
So Chen, we were saying you would be a very good deadpan comedian with that kick gas pronunciation. very, very articulate pronunciation.
That was really interesting. I was late, but I really enjoyed it. And
thanks.
I got in just as you were talking about the confirmation of the deformation of the